Hi, Tony, the Demolition Man. Welcome to Metal Sock Finland. You know, it's so nice to talk finally with you. And I know that you are very busy in these days because you are about to start your upcoming tour. But about that, we will talk later on. First of all, how are you doing?
Yeah, well, it's lovely to speak to you at last properly. And I'm doing good. I'm a bit tired. Yeah, it's just a bit crazy because the whole Venomy thing is sort of took over from everything else. Yeah. Basically, when we began the year, myself and Mantis, we were doing the Empire of Evil. We'd completed the writing for the album, and we were in a state where we were just going to complete the drum tracks. And then take our time. I would go to Portugal. We had some shows lined up and some tour dates. January was Obituary. We went through Europe and then we went to Russia and then we had some festival shows. So we plotted the summer was going to be pretty much free. And then I'd go to Portugal, spend a week or so, finish the bass and vocals, and then we'd just mix and we'd be ready by the end of the year, where we'd pick up some more shows and that would be our year. And what happened was in January of last year, I was contacted by some guys in Newcastle in the north of England who do a festival, a retro festival, new wave bands like, you know, Blitzkrieg, Satan, all that new wave of British heavy metal. And they're very nice young guys and they got in touch with me and suggested that I would maybe perform as my former band at Atomcraft, a special performance. But of course, the band split up many, many moons ago. Lots of things happened with the personalities. So the idea of realizing the original lineup was never going to happen. And I kind of don't worry too much about original lineups. I think about the music more. And if someone's there and they're playing the music and that person was there at the time, then that's good enough for me. But I know lots of people are purists and that's not so good for them. Anyway, I'd considered it, and I said, well, I could get a couple of musicians that I use when I do play Atomcraft material. Yeah. And they suggested I play the first ever album that we did in its entirety only. And that was what excited me, because although I played odd songs with the air, when we played the first shows with Slayer, we did stuff from the album. I'd never done the whole album, like top to tail. So, you know, it's not a remarkable album, but it is part of my history and something I was intrigued by. So I said, okay, I'll do that. So, of course, I went up to Newcastle, rehearsed with my guys, a guy called Graham Meyer from Denmark is my guitarist, and Paul Caffrey from Gamma Bomb plays drums for me for the Atomcraft thing. So we went into rehearsals, and of course, Mantis was there. Because he's like my brother, but also he lives in Newcastle. Or he lived in Newcastle. Yeah. He's now in Lisbon. But he came to rehearsals and then said, oh, I always liked this song. And I said, well, stick a guitar in and fucking play it then. Yeah. So he did.
What
and
are you waiting said, well, for?
Yeah. And I said, well, if you're going to play that song, you have to play this song. Yeah. So anyway, we played the show. I invited Mantis on stage. We had a great time. And that was that. And off I went home. And then I got an email from a guy called Oliver Weisenhammer, who does the Keep It True Festival in Germany. Again, a very traditional retro festival. And he said he was there, he really enjoyed the show. He loved that I got Mantis up, but he said that he deserved that Abaddon was standing in the audience. And it crossed his mind, oh, you should have got Abaddon up and maybe played a couple of Venom songs. And I said, well, that didn't really fit, and there was a lot of politics in Venom. You can't just invite people on stage. It doesn't work like that. With other bands, it's normal.
Because it's not jam, it's not jamming, but...
not at all. So, anyway, he said, well, look, I've got an idea. If I booked Empire of Evil to play Keep It True, and Abaddon just happened to be there, what's the chances of you inviting him on stage and playing maybe a song? So I ran it through Mantis, and his first reaction was nowhere. And then I spoke to Abaddon, and he was up for it. So I thought, okay, maybe this could be cool for fans. So that's what we did. I managed to make it all work out. We went with the intention to play half the set would be Empire of Evil. So we'd play half as Empire of Evil. Yeah. And then the second half, I'd switch drummers, we'd switch intros, and we'd bring Abaddon on as a surprise, and then we'd play the second half as Venom, and just play five or six Venom classics. Not particularly my era, just Venom classic songs, so the audience would rejoice, we hoped. And, you know, there was about 2,000 people there. We didn't get time to rehearse with Abaddon, so we basically just sent set lists and we all came in ready to get on stage. Yeah. Mantis was really sick, unfortunately, because in Russia he'd contracted something.
Okay.
I don't know how. It was a pretty rough ride, Russia. You know, a lot of long journeys, very cold, you know, not so much sleep and stuff. And he was susceptible to that type of environment. And he got something that was made him very... When he turned up in Germany... He could hardly stand up, and he was white, and I thought, fuck, I didn't know if we could actually play, but I was going, my God, this is so important, and now you're so sick, we have to do it. So he was brave enough to say, yep, no, let's just do it, but I'll try my best, which is what he did.
Yeah.
So the performance was going to be a bit loose anyway, but I thought, you know, the spirit of Venom was never about the technical ability, was never about the precision. It was about the energy and the size of it and just the explosion of colour that was just noise and movement. And so I thought, well, if anything else, I know we're capable of that.
Yeah.
So if the purists want to hear, you know, something perfect, they're going to listen to the other bands. If they want to hear something that's venomous, then it doesn't matter what we do. We just have to drive the truck as fast as we can and hit the wall. So that's basically what we did. And we ended the Empire set with Countess Bathory, and the place went crazy. There's like 1,800 people singing the chorus so loud, I couldn't even hear the PA. I couldn't hear any of the words. And then we went off. Then a chant for Venom, Venom came on, and we brought Abaddon on, and from then on it was just breathtaking. I really was shocked, as we all were. And by the time we'd left the venue, I went back to the hotel, no sleep because we had a very early flight. By the time I got to the airport to come home, I was getting messages from my agent saying, the thing's gone viral, there's videos going up, and I've just had a promoter from China saying, can we book Asia and South America? And it looks like I've got some European people who are desperate to put something together. So, we were shocked, really. We basically went home and thought, shit, can we actually do this? And how do we do it?
Yeah.
So we'd already came up with a name for it, just Iron and Steel, which is a line from a Die Hard, a classic Venom song, Legion's Iron and Steel. So we thought, well, Iron and Steel, because it's about the fans, not about the band. But then people wanted us to use the name Venom and thought we should, because Abaddon and Mantis were there.
Yeah.
People had wanted a revival, like an original lineup, the three of them. But Kronos is in another place. He doesn't want to know. He hates them. He's trying to rewrite the whole history of Venom to make it all him and to make sure that they're not mentioned and they weren't important.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, okay, well, if fans want to see you guys play and fans want to hear classic Venom songs, and there's no possible way that you're going to be able to do that with Kronos, who is out with his own band doing new material, then I'll step in. At least it's kind of legitimate. I was there, we'll play whatever the fuck we want, whatever the fuck the fans want to hear. And so it became about the fans. And then our agent suggested that we use Venom Incorporated, based on the fact that we were all in Venom at some point, and although we have our new projects, and Abaddon has his Abaddon band, Jeff does his side projects, I do mine, and we have Empire of Evil. We thought, well, if we say we're Venom Incorporated, it has two meanings. It covers everything we do, and whatever we do is Iron and Steel, we're incorporating Venom into it. So that's kind of my long, long-winded, you couldn't get a word in edgeways description of what brought us to this point.
In fact, and I was asking you that, because we are now talking face-to-face, and I was asking you because the next question was about this reunion and what happened at that. So you replied me, and also you explained me about this Iron and Steel. What was the third question? So are you reading my notes here?
Yes, I can see them. You know, because of the technology, we got a Skype, I can see the bit of paper.
In fact, so the next...
I hold hold the phone at an angle, I can see your desk and everything.
Oh, cool, cool, cool. So I just let you read. No. We will go forward. Okay. I know that you're very busy today, especially in these days. So I try to be synthetic, but it's very difficult with you because there are so many topics to talk about, but we will try. Now let's talk about this upcoming tour that kicks off this Friday. So
that's right.
So with Vader, Divine Chaos, and Witches. Yes. And you are going to play across Europe. So how have you been and how are you preparing for it in these days? This hectic day?
Well, I'll probably have a bath and I'll have a shave.
Oh.
I might even pack my bag and I'll take my bass. And that's how I'm preparing.
Okay, cool.
No, I'm only kidding. And the idea of Vader, who are, fans and were interested to join us. And, they're an iconic Polish thrash band. And, they're great guys, a great band.
Yes.
And we, they have a whole legacy also. So we thought the idea of us both bands going out and playing our legacy...
Yes.
Is a fantastic idea, so people can come and they can, they can relive a moment, or they can be 16 again, or they can just let themselves go. It's not a tour for people to come out and want to be hypercritical. Mm. This isn't Machine Head and Lamb of God trying to, sell a new album, and this isn't, Metallica and Sabbath trying to sell you as much merch as they can. This is not about money. This is not about pushing young guys with new products and trying to get magazine covers. This is pure music.
Yes.
For music's sake. And
as it should
if you think
be.
That's,
yes, as
yeah.
It should be always, to my
I
knowledge.
Think
maybe.
So.
Yes.
I think so, Tara. And I think, a lot of that times it's missing.
Yes.
People are trying to sell products so... even bands as a product.
Mm.
And there's something cool about the traditional bands, about the older bands.
Yeah.
Because when you look back, you had your Judas Priest and your Black Sabbaths and your Motorheads. And, there weren't two bands. It was categorized, surely, as rock music or heavy metal. But there weren't two bands you could say, well, that band's just in that same vein as that band. They were all iconic, but they were all very different, which is what makes them iconic.
Yeah.
And I think these days it's because of the labels predominantly trying to moderate the market so that they still have an income, and not about the bands, that they've forged all these genres. Of course the bands themselves want to be different, so they try and create a genre for themselves that nobody's had.
Yeah.
Like the folk metal and stuff, so they will look to their own genres, as all youth does, looks to have their own voice. But the labels drove it down that path because they thought, well, if we can't sell an item to a market as a mass, maybe we can make money here and money there if we separate them into little pockets and see which one makes the most money, and we'll follow that one down.
That sort of bad point when we're talking about this commercial thing, when music comes too commercial. I know that everybody needs to make living on it, but when it goes further and becomes too commercial, then it loses something.
Yes, you can't homogenize music.
Yeah.
You can develop it and you can change it, but once you start to, if you in the 80s, Three Gentlemen, Stock, Aitken and Waterman had a success writing particular type of pop music.
Yeah.
And from Jason Donovan, Kylie Minogue, Rick Astley, they had a catalogue of people, Senita, who all came through. But if you listen to the songs, any of those artists could have been singing any of those songs.
Yeah.
They had a technique and they knew it sold, and so they just looked for another artist to sing that type of song, and they just kept making money. But eventually it wears out, the wheel falls off, because the 16-year-old, 13-year-olds grow up. I once went to a songwriting sort of symposium or whatever it is, but I went to this songwriting thing, and at the very next table along was Posh Spice.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria Beckham. Now, she'd just done a some dance hip single thing with this rapper guy or whatever.
Yeah.
And I overheard her saying that she was so pissed off that these people were all getting recognised.
Mm.
She thought she'd done a great album and she wasn't getting the recognition.
Mm.
And it really, I really felt like saying to her, you were exploited to 10-year-old children who became 11, 12, 13, 14. So when they look back, they look at those times fondly. However, you spend so much time being undersold to children that adults didn't take you seriously.
Yeah.
Now those children grow up and they're adults, and now they want to listen to serious music.
Yes.
So of course nobody's going to take you seriously. You weren't a serious artist. You were put together by Sony to be sold as a product.
Yeah.
And you know, you were quite willing to do that. So now you want to be Elton John. It doesn't work like that.
No,
it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Elton John was always Elton John.
Yes.
You know, Eric Clapton was always Eric Clapton. It's like a clown spending his life being a clown very successfully and then wanting to be a high court judge and wondering why people are laughing at him because he's still wearing the red nose. It's like,
yes,
because you're a clown. You know,
So
those analogies stay true, and I just think that the labels sometimes will jump on an artist or a particular genre and then buy up all of that.
Yes, yes, and they finished the artistical freedom. I mean, it's like a slavery. I mean, then you are not doing the music for music.
Completely. If you look at a lot of commentary, a lot of status from bands that have had problems with labels, the first thing they say is, we're now free of label, we're going to do what we want to do.
Yeah.
So, the label didn't like this album because it didn't conform.
Mm.
So, you know, it's like every artist says that, because if a label thinks, I once went to Virgin Records when I was doing a games project for the Sony PlayStation, and there was some music that I'd done for it, and the guy listened and went, this is great. I said, oh, you like it? Brilliant, that's great. He said, yeah, but I don't think we would be interested in this for the game. And I said, why? And he said, well, we're kind of looking for another Radiohead. And I said, but don't you want, like, another band that's as unique as Radiohead? Or you want a band that sounds like Radiohead? He said, well, a band that sounds like Radiohead because they're selling so well. And I said, but you don't need another Radiohead. You need another band that sells as well, that's
like a tribute.
Unique.
Like a tribute, yeah.
Yes, and that's the catch-22 they get into. They need to be safe. Only 5 years ago, almost, we started Empire.
Mm.
And we did a four-track demo. And I sent it out. I thought it was pretty good. And I sent it out to, you know, Century Media, blah, blah, blah. You know, everybody, the usual. And nothing. Nada. Nobody that came back to me. And I thought, this is really odd. And I spoke to Monty Connor, who was still the roadrunner at the time out of New York. And I said, Monty, you know, you... And he said, yeah, it's good. It's good. And I said, yeah, but people seem to be saying it sounds good, but nobody's kind of interested. He said, well, yeah, it's just the market. I said, yeah, but what do you mean it's the market? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, it's just the way the market is. It's not what people are looking for. I said, who's not looking for it? He said, well, the labels. And I said, what are they looking for then? I mean, you know, I said, if you can critically tell me, then I can go away and do something about it. Like, if you say, well, it's shit, the songs are shit, I can go away and we can write better songs. If you say the sound is shit, we can go and do better sounds.
Yeah.
If you say the production shit, I can go and get it produced better. But nobody's saying why, they're just saying no. And he said, well, basically, you're too old school. And I said, okay, so what does that mean? You mean I'm too old, or the sound? And he said, well, yeah, it sounds too old school. It's not the sound of what's happening in metal right now. So I said, okay. I said, but I think that will change because this is the traditional sounding. I said, and, you know, Judas Priest are old school. Kiss are old school. Metallica's old school now. So you're saying that those... Oh, well, that's different.
I said, yes, they are. Okay, okay. I know the point. Oh, my God.
So Fast forward, 3 years later, nuclear blast and everybody else is buying up bands as fast as they can. Destruction and Vader, you know, and, you know, everybody putting Nuclear Assault back together, putting Dark Angel back together. Yeah. It's like, you know, the new wave of British heavy metal bands here, Tigers of Pang Tang, Satan, Blitzkrieg. You know, they've all got a new lease of life. Why? Because everybody wants old school.
Yes. In fact, I was going to that old school never dies.
Never dies.
Never.
So, you know, I guess we were caught it just before it broke again. And I was the door was being shut because we were old school. And now they can't trip over themselves trying to get the next old school band back together to get them out there.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem with the industry. You know, they can't second guess what's happening.
Yeah.
They don't have an open mind a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And they try and keep the bands homogenized. You know, it's a shame. It's a shame.
Very
but the only losers are the fans, because if you buy a magazine and X are on the front cover who you never fucking heard of, and all of a sudden they're on every festival stage, but you never heard them before, and you're told that they're brilliant, and you're told that they're fantastic, and you're told that they're amazing, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm not saying anything about Ghost, but using that as an example, all of a sudden James Hetfield is wearing a Ghost t-shirt, and Kerry King's going to see Ghost, you know, all of a sudden you've got basically a soft rock band from the 1970s
yes.
who were not really heard of, but look great and do have a stage show. All of a sudden the kids think, wow, these are an iconic band that I must have missed somewhere. I should go and buy into it.
Yes.
And
that's
so their label buys them up, buys them stage space at major festivals, buys them magazine covers. So, like I say, I'm just using Ghost in that example as you can see at that level how the kids are manipulated by the label in particular, because they know if we get in quick, we can make a shitload of money off this band.
Mm.
You know, make a cardboard cutout Pope's head piece and put it on a magazine cover and it's marketable, you know. And, you know, baby metal, they're doing it with baby metal and, you know, they'll just market it. Now, baby metal, you know, they're great musicians. Those girls can sing and they're very pretty. But is it about the music, or is it about the fact you've got three very young, very pretty giant Japanese girls doing the whole cute little, that's what it's about. And they'll get front covers and they'll get loads of coverage. And, you know, there'll be a band out there who is a great band. They've written great material. They've played loads of shows. They've really worked themselves to death and will not get any coverage because they haven't got that. And I think that's a shame.
Yes.
And the labels then tag that. And some of the magazines fall into it by going, well, that's underground. Fucking, what is underground? Underground means you're not on a label, or that you're doing it for yourself, or that you're just doing it with the fans.
Yes.
It means that there's nobody putting money into you. You've got to make it yourself. That's what they say signifies underground, because we can't sign you or we're not willing to invest in you. And I think if it wasn't for the underground, we wouldn't have this amazing thing.
Yes, in fact, I fully agree on that. But Tony, we go forward. We can talk all night long. I don't have any other meetings.
Don't say that, because I will just talk, you know.
I let you to talk because I want to hear what you think about these things.
Okay.
And but going back to the upcoming tour.
Sure.
Talking about the set list, can you reveal me something more about it? Any surprises for your fans?
Well, what I wanted to do, I mean, I because we lack rehearsal time, so we basically got a set list that we performed, which we did through Asia, and we did it Beamageddon in the UK a couple of weeks ago.
Mm.
But what I wanted to do was I wanted to take, you know, material that had never been played, or that people never had a chance to play, because obviously the Venom catalogue is so rich in classic songs, you know, Seven Gates of Hell, Die Hard, Countess Basti, Welcome to Hell, you know, that it's so rich in all of that. But I wanted to look for those B-sides. I mean, we did it in the 90s when I was in there. I picked Bursting Out.
Yeah.
We did Angel Dust. You know, I wanted to do something more traditional. And now the approach is a bit more real, a bit more Venom this time, traditionally. So it's Wyatt, Keep It True. I added Sons of Satan. You know, I think Tony and Jeff were a bit, are you sure? And I said, yeah, absolutely. You know, because the first single was In Big was Satan, of course, lived like an angel. But, you know, when you first put on Welcome to Hell, Sons of Satan was the first thing that hit you in the face. And it just comes in like, you know, an explosion of like, where is this going? And where did it come from? And what's happening? I thought if we could play Sons of Satan and it feels like it's real, then everything else is easy. And so I wanted to try something too, because that, for me, sets the energy level of Venom. You know, so I've got songs in there that I want to do. Lady Lust, you know, Dead of the Night, Manitou was never done. Nightmare would be cool to do, but Warheads in there, you know, obviously Seven Gates of Hell, you know. But then I want to draw from songs that people like. School Days from Primeval, which is a fun song, a blues song, but people really enjoyed that. Of course, Primeval, Parasite, Blackened Are the Priests, Carnivorous, you know, people. But it seems to be that every time we compile a list, and I think, yeah, as a fan and also as a musician, I think, ah, oh, that's a great set. And then someone writes to me and says, oh, this is my favorite song. It's a song that we don't have in the set. So, you know, it's going to be impossible to play every single song that everybody wants to hear.
How long is the set? Sorry.
Well, it should last about a day and a half with the amount of songs.
Okay, okay.
But I think I want to get to at least 2 hours. Okay, you know, cool. I don't want to go much more. But even if it's under that, what I want to do is I want to make it so entertaining, so connective with the audience, so that they're participating in it so much, and that we feed off them and they feed off us, that we all have such a great time. But I don't want it to get to a point where people are going, right, okay, that's enough. And if we come off stage and they want us to keep going, which has been happening to us, we go off and they go, no more, just play one more. And so we go on and play one more. And then, thank you very much. And we come off and go, I've got to play one more, please.
Oh, that's so that, good.
And of course, it's the strength of, again, the strength of the catalogue is so strong. But that's a great position to be in. I'd rather be in that position.
Yeah.
So the idea is we have our set list, which should be, you know, getting close to 2 hours. And then I have a second set list, which are all songs I want to try and include. So with this being out there for so long, we have a month, I want to be able to include one song a night that's different. You know, when we play the first show on Friday, the people on the last day of the tour are going to know exactly what the set list is, because people will film it, it'll go up on the internet, there'll be pictures of the set list, and everybody knows what's coming. Whereas what I want to do is to change it.
Yeah.
So that, you know, maybe this, a handful of them, maybe some shape of it, but you're going to get something that they never got.
Yes.
And if I can do that every night with a bit of luck, then that's going to be fantastic. Each person at each show will get their own show.
Oh, great.
With something special in there. Yeah. So that's the idea.
Great. And I'm looking very much forward, because it will be my huge pleasure to see both you and Vader at the end of this month in Torino. And
yes.
That's great.
Great.
So I will looking forward what surprise you have for that night, of course.
Well, big surprise. Great. I got to show you the tour bus and get you some nice wine.
Okay, cool. And I bring you the tequila bottle.
Yes, okay. That's, I'll probably have fun. Some anyway.
Yeah, I know. Listen, anyhow, what are your expectations about this tour in general?
Well, you know, I think I'm anxious, not nervous about performing. You know, I'm always ready for playing and performing and stuff, but I want people to not feel that they're judging, because you have the Kronos side of this.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of bad blood between Kronos and Mantis and Abaddon.
Okay.
And inevitably there'll be comparisons. Mm. But, you know, personally, as a one-to-one, I don't give a shit what he says, what he does, or anything. And you know, he's iconic. And so I appreciate that. And I appreciate the fans see that. Mm. And, you know, this is about the songs. Venom is not about an individual. You know, Venom is about a spirit and a feeling an entity. It's an entity. It's like the Sex Pistols or Jim Morrison and the Doors in a way. You know, although probably that's a bad example for Jim Morrison, but you know what I mean. There was something. There's something quite his spirit, I guess. What I was going, Hendrix. You know, there was more than just the player. There was something else happening,
yeah.
And it freed your spirit to partake in it, to let yourself go. And I think that's for me is the idea of the Venom thing. So I would just like people to not. If you don't want to come, don't come. If you prefer, then okay. But don't judge before you've seen it. Mm. Let yourself come. And when you come, just think this. You're coming to enjoy yourself.
Yes.
You know, it may be a curiosity, but you're there. So come, let yourself have the experience. If you go away and, you know, Witches are an amazing band. You know, Sibyl's been a friend for a long time and dying to play shows with us. Divine Chaos are a really great band, really nice guys, great, great band. Vader, of course, are classic. And then there's us to top it off. If you come and none of us can make you enjoy yourself, and you go away and go, that was a shit night, then that's absolutely fine. You never, ever have to come again. Regardless of what we say or what we do, ever. Even if we make a platinum CD, you don't have to come. You know, I'll give you the money for the ticket. You can stay home and watch a TV. Just let yourself go. Don't have any preconceptions. Don't have any this, it's this or that, or it's them or this. You know, come and just smile. Keep your mind free. And it's your night. So drink. Get involved and just let yourself go. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. That's what I hope. And that's what I'm hoping for the tour, that we get everybody comes, we fill it out, and they all go away with big fucking smiles on their face, go, that was a great night.
Oh, that's great. And you know what? We are going to talk about this tour at the end of this month when we see in Torino. So
yes.
I'm going to ask you how the first 2 weeks have been.
Well, let's just say that if you come in Torino and wear shit, I'm going to feel really bad.
Don't you worry about that. I'm sure it's all the contrary. Okay, Tony. Before we go further to talking about the other topics, let's talk about you.
Okay.
You mentioned already about Atomic Craft, and the album Future Various came out in 85, so 30 years ago. Listen, I'd like to know how you got into the music.
Well, you know, it was my mother and father split when I was nine.
Okay.
In the early 70s, and then quite soon after, maybe related to that, my mother had another guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I have an older sister from my father and then a younger sister from my stepfather. But they decided we'd move to Canada, so we moved to Canada in the 70s. And, you know, I had some glorious summers there and you know, discovered it was glam rock was happening in England when I left, which I enjoyed, you know, Slade, Sweet and all of that sort of thing. And then I went to Canada and I was introduced to Aerosmith and Kiss and Creedence Clearwater Revival and Neil Young. And I was like, wow, this is cool. You know, and we'd hang out in the summers with all of that playing. And, you know, I'd go trick-or-treating dressed as Kiss. And my hair grew long. My skin got tanned. And then all of a sudden one day, I think it was about 14, my mom said, okay, we're going back to England. So I was like, oh, cool. That's going to be so cool. I get to see people and visit again. And so we came back to England. But what I didn't realize was we were moving back to England. We weren't going back to Canada.
Ooh.
So after 6 months, my older sister, who was pregnant and had her, who was to be her husband there, her partner, they decided they were going back to Canada. And so I just began to pack my bags until my mom said, we're not going, they're going, you're not going. And I was like, oh, no. I thought, fucking hell, I don't want to live here. No way. But she said, that's it. When the summer finishes, you'll be going to school and we're staying. And I was horrified because I felt free in Canada. I felt that I was liberated. And now I was back with very little greenery, with, you know, streets that when it rained, they smell of dog shit in the summer, and I just thought, no. But that was it, we were staying. And so school began, I went to school dressed in my flares with my long hair and my Kiss Army patch on my jacket. And my first introduction to school and everybody was, that stage, was a school disco. And when I walked in, it was 1977, 78. Punk rock was had blown. And I was confronted with all of this thing, this music and these people. And everybody was coming back and pushing me, calling me a hippie and asking me, who the fuck is Kiss? and why is your hair long? And why are you wearing flares? And I was thinking, eh? So it was like being a fish out of the bowl. I just thought, this is, what is going on? I was like on another planet. But very soon, you know, of course you adapt. That's the beauty of human nature. We can live in a desert or in the North Pole and we just adapt to our environment. I adapted to it. Began to listen to some of these songs, and what I liked was the energy. You know, rock music had been good. You know, I was listening to Chris Rea, Fool for Your Loving. You know, you can't compare that to Anarchy in the UK. So the energy was like on another planet. And I thought, wow, this is something else. And of course, I was at the right age. My hormones were raging. My vitriolic stance because of my youth was that I was opinionated on everything, and here was my voice. This was this music. I could have a voice. And I didn't have to play. I couldn't play an instrument, but these guys didn't sound like they were experts. So I thought, well, I could do that. And so very quickly, me and a friend, his brother had some instruments, and I said, why don't we have a band? So he said, yeah, we should have a band. So we used to go on a Saturday, abuse his brother's instruments, write what we thought were songs which weren't, and we formed a punk band with some guys from school, and we did some tapes, and we even did a couple of shows. And then I went to my friend, who became the first drummer in Atomcraft on the first demos. I went to his house one day, and he was painting a picture on his bedroom wall. He's a very good artist. He was painting, and I said, what is that? And he said, it's Motorhead. It was AC/DC. And I said, "What AC/DC, what's that?" And he said, it's a band, you know, you should hear them, they're really good. And I thought, oh, wow, great, great. And he put on whatever it was, Dirty Deeds or TNT or something, and High Voltage or something like that. And I was listening to it, and I didn't get it. I was thinking, these guys don't sound very punk, though. I mean, where are they from? He said, they're Australian. And I thought, oh, that's the punk scene in Australia. And he said, no, they're not punk, they're rock, they're like heavy metal. And I was like, heavy metal?
Heavy what?
I didn't get it. And then my next adventure, on the back of that, because I thought, well, that's strange, but we're still doing our punk thing, was a friend's band of mine were playing in Newcastle, supporting another band. So I went up there, invited to see them. And when I got there, I met the guys and I said, oh, yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing you. And they said, yeah, you should see the band we're with. We heard them in soundcheck. Fucking hell, you're going to like them. And I said, really? They said, yeah, they're really intense. So I thought, oh, fantastic, you know, a bit like the Angelic Upstarts or something, me thinks. So anyway, my friend's band play, off they go, the lights go out. I make sure I get to the front. And then I just hear this noise, this rumbling, deep rumbling bass. And bang, the lights go on, and there's three guys, the two guys at the front, only three in the band, two guys at the front, both with black trousers, with black shirts on, long hair, and with bullet belts on. And there was Lemmy on the left, and there was Eddie on the right. And I stood there, and that changed my life.
Okay.
Within a month,
that was I'd, the moment.
Convinced my mum to help me get a Rickenbacker. No case, no strap, no pickups, no amp, nothing. But I sat down with that in my bedroom, and I bought everything or traded tapes of everything I could find from Motorhead, and I learned every bass lick of everything he ever did. And that was all I could ever play.
Yeah.
And then took that to rehearsals and said, let's do Stay Clean. And they were like, what the fuck is Stay Clean? And I said, oh, it's by Motorhead. And they were like, well, aren't they a heavy metal band or hippies or something? And I said, yeah, but it's a great song. And then let's play Lost Johnny. Let's play Motorhead. Let's play this. And very soon the drummer went, you like heavy metal? We should just be a heavy metal band. And we went, yeah, fuck it. Let's just be heavy metal. And that was it.
That was
from
it.
From then on.
That was the moment. couple of years have passed, okay? We are not counting them.
Bless you.
Because I'm older than you.
Just your forehead for that.
Just a little bit. What is the fire inside of you that keeps you going on?
Passion. Mm. Passion for people. Mm. Passion for life. Mm. Passion for entertaining, and a passion for, it sounds crazy to say a romance, mm-hmm. but Shakespeare said, if music be the food of love, play on.
Yeah.
And it's true. And yeah. you can find solace in music. You can find your voice in music if you can't express yourself.
Yes.
And it can calm you. It can... make you quizzical. It can help your anger, your expression. And so there's a synergy between humans and rhythm. Anything rhythmic, if you listen, you know, around, you'll hear the wind yeah. blowing the trees. There's yeah. a rhythm, a train on a track. There's a rhythm, a wheel going round, your kettle boiling. You know, there's rhythm in everything.
In
it's
everything,
part of
yes.
it's part of the energy of the universe. And so to create music, I think, is like good art, someone painting, or there's such an expressive quality in it. And it's, we talked about music being homogenized, but each person, it puts themselves into their performance, into their music, into their skill. And so two or three guitarists, 10 guitarists, 50 guitarists may be able to play the same riff, but nobody can play Smoke on the Water the way Ritchie Blackmore played Smoke
yes,
on the Water.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't mean Smoke on the Water is not a great song and someone could play it really well, but there's only one person who can play it that way. If they're the first person who did it,
yeah.
that should be celebrated, their uniqueness. Always.
Yes.
But then we rejoice in buying their art or seeing their art or copying their
yes.
art or playing, you know, we're rejoicing in who that person was and what they created. And I think you cannot separate music from our soul, but you also cannot separate creativity from humans. And I think that's where my passion lies is, you know, in a tutorial class at school once, when they were asking people, you know, about 15, I guess, and they were asking, what do you want to do when you leave school? And it got round to me, and it was like, hadn't thought about it. But they said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, you know, meet everybody I can on the planet before I die. And they said, but that's...
And now you're
that's
doing.
Yeah, they said it's unrealistic. And I said, of course, I can't meet everybody. But I can meet as many as possible, and that's what I want to do. I want to experience their culture. I want to taste their food. I want to hear their music. I want to speak to them, and it won't always be possible. But you can try, and that's all I want to do. I want to see the other people on my planet and know that we're all on the same planet. And, you know, it's like I said to someone just the other day in a piece, that music, the beauty is it transcends
yeah.
everything.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, if I go to Osaka or Kyoto, I don't speak very well Japanese. Mm, in fact, you could probably say, I don't speak Japanese.
Yes.
But if they don't speak English, I'm kind of in a quagmire. But also if I go to, you know, Latin America, I speak some Spanish, understand a bit of Spanish, but it's certainly not enough.
Yeah.
Or Portuguese.
Yes.
You know, French, I should have it. It's our second language, but I'm not so good. Swedish. Yeah, I'm lost there.
Finnish.
Danish, Russian, you know, Chinese, you know, Mandarin. I mean, my God, there's 450 types of Chinese. But if I go to any one of those countries and we sing Countess Bathory, all of the fans in all of those places sing it back.
Yes.
And that's the incredible thing.
Yes.
We can't say, how are you? To each other, and would you like some coffee? Yet we can all stand and sing the same song.
That's
I think
true.
That's amazing.
Yes, that's the miracle of music when you yeah. do it in the right way.
A miracle,
and
yeah.
with the
it's
right spirit as well. And now back to presence, or anyhow, we are talking all about, because all these, what we are talking about, they make part of the present. But
yes,
talking about timely presents, in April you announced...
You don't have to give me presents, but you can if you want. Sorry, I just... sorry, carry on, sorry.
In April you announced the reunion of Venom Inc. But you revealed also, and you mentioned also something about the record, brand new album.
Yeah.
So what you can reveal, when, what, and how, and anything. I'm open. I'm all ears.
Well, again, because the Venom Inc. wasn't something we'd intended or planned, it just kind of happened.
Yes.
And so what I said to the boys was like, don't try and control this. Don't try and shape it into any form. Let it just happen. If it wants to happen, it will happen.
Yes.
So we let that happen. But very quickly, people wanted to know, are you going to record?
Of
so we thought, well, okay, we should think about that.
Mm.
So Italian Metal Hammer, which happened for about 2 months, and then got folded up. But one of the sub-editors contacted me and wanted to do a front cover, wanted to do a feature as the launch of the magazine.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So for 2 months or more, we were talking about that, sending stuff. They had a special cover drawn up for us. And I thought, okay, we should put a song on there.
Yeah.
So they can give it away. So I actually composed a song called Metal Hammer.
Oh,
for Venom Inc.,
yes.
Which we've demoed, and we have that. And then, of course, that magazine didn't make it to the shelves, so it was like, fuck, okay. So the song just went into our folder. But then Mantis was inspired by that, and then he wrote a song and said, oh, I've wrote this. So we listened, thought, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. So then we decided, well, look, this is the plan. We get the Empire of Evil album, because we're very excited by that,
yes.
Unleashed, out the way. And then we'll just spend the tour now, so because we do Europe, and then we finish for about 2 weeks, and then we go to North America. The dates are announced next week, I think. And then we go straight into South America, finish up just before Christmas. So we thought, we're going to have all of this time. We should just write. So that's what we're doing. So we've got two songs that we had in a rough demo state, but between now and then, all our ideas, we're just going to, because we'll be spending time together,
yes.
Because it's not always easy. Abaddon lives in Newcastle. I live 300 odd miles away in London. Mantis lives in Portugal. So it's all done by internet.
Yes.
Hooray for technology. And we can share things, which is brilliant. But being in the same room sometimes,
yes,
for that spontaneity,
yeah.
Difficult. So now we're going to have the opportunity. So by the end of this tour, we will have what amounts to an album's worth of material. We'll go back, we'll demo our parts, and then we'll bring it together, and that's it. So I'm hoping we start next year in February. We've got Asia again, some more dates in South America to finish off, and we may have another few in America to go back and do, but as a stepping stone into Japan, where we have to be again in Osaka and Tokyo in February. Then we go into China, and then we go to Singapore, Bangkok, and then last night we got news that they would like to bring us into Australia and New Zealand following that.
Mm-hmm.
So that would take us to around about March, which is when I'd really like to get the release ready.
Yes. Yes.
So that's the intention now, is to ride throughout the tour because we've got the time and we're together, and then finish the tour over the Christmas into the new year, put it together, and then hit the new shows in February, end of January into February. By March, we should have the album ready.
Oh, great, great. We will talk before it comes out, or near to that moment, we will have another chat to talk more about this new baby.
Well, as soon as we've got anything that is, I shall make sure you get a sneak preview.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Listen, so now you already mentioned about Empire of Evil.
Yeah.
And recently you made three great festivals. first of all Pikers Fest in Italy, then Pier Macedon Fest in UK, and the latest was this Goel Fest in France.
Goel, yes.
Goel, yeah. I don't speak French, but I tried.
Well, I thought, Goel, when they go said, hell. I thought it was Goel, but okay. Actually, when we arrived, it's actually a place in France called Goel. Goel.
Yeah. That's great. So how were them?
They were great. Brescia was, Bergamo, the Biker Fest was amazing. It was all Hell's Angels and Italian bike clubs and stuff, but loads of beer, loads of heavy metal and rock music and loads of bikes everywhere. Yeah. And there was no trouble and there was families with their children. There was such an amazing atmosphere. And a lot of people had stalls where they made things and it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The weather was fantastic, of course. And we had a really nice time and people had travelled also from where we played in Padova, the Metal Fest in Padova. They came from Venice
to see you.
Come and see us. Yes. Yeah, and that was lovely. It was like seeing some old friends. And, you know, two of my things when we started Empire was we should play France more because back in the day, everybody ever just travelled through France. Apart from playing Paris, nobody played France. They just went straight to the next destination. Yeah. And I was thinking, well, you would play Belgium and you would play Holland and you would go to Germany or Spain, even Portugal. Why is nobody stopping in France? So I wanted to play France more, which is what we've done, and also Italy, because I have a love for Italy. I've always had a great love for Italy. So, you know, we've made a point of playing Italy a lot because I like to be there. So, so it was like being home. And just seeing our friends as well as some new people. What's nice is to see young people at the shows.
Yes,
but we went to, Goel was amazing. Just the French, we had our French fan club people there. We had local dishes. The atmosphere was fantastic. The hall was great. The technicians were superb. Mm-hmm. And the welcoming committee from Lionel and his people was like, I was a long lost family. He's like, Lionel, one of the main promoters, the guy's like about 7 feet tall, weighs about 300 pounds, kept slapping me on the back with such a big laugh. I thought he's going to break one of my ribs, you know, but it was so wonderful and so welcoming. It was so nice and great show. But when we did Beer Mageddon, was actually scheduled as an Empire of Evil show because we had to go from Bergamo to London, London to Goel to France. Logistically, because I live in the UK, Francesco Frullo La Rossa is Milan-based, although he's from Genoa, but he's Milano-based. And, of course, Mantis is in Lisbon. So the shows were close together, but not so close. It was going to involve so many flights, and it was going to be a bit awkward for us.
Yeah.
So I was going to cancel one of the shows, either Goel or the UK show, to make it easier for us to get travel.
Yes.
But anyway, I had a thought. So what we ended up doing was Francesco played in Bergamo, Bikerfest, and then we planned for him to play in Goel because he could get a train from there to there.
Yes.
We flew back to the UK and I brought Abaddon down from Newcastle and we actually played Beer Mageddon as Venom Inc., but nobody thought it was going to happen.
Yeah.
So we kind of did like a private show as a surprise.
And it was sold out as well.
And it was, you know, what I'd created a particular video. So before we went on, the promoter went on stage and he addressed the audience and said, you know, I'm really, really sorry. The intention was to have Empire of Evil, but there was issues with the drummer, so we weren't able to make the band happen for you. I apologise for that. They're a great British band and blah, 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 blah. He said, but they got a different drummer, but I think they've called themselves something else. And then he left, and then I had a video running which came on, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. And then a picture of Mantis, a picture of me, finally a picture of Abaddon, and then our intro started and that was it. We went on as Venom Inc. and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and what was funny was it was the last day of the festival and it was on a Sunday. So, of course, you know, lots of people had traveled there and they had work the next day.
Yeah,
so
sure.
People were leaving before we went on and we were going, oh, people are leaving. He said, yeah, they've got to travel. He said, but what are we going to do? We haven't told them what's happening. He said, I think that's going to work well. So And what it was exactly right. After we'd played, there was people commenting and they were phoning people who'd left going, oh my God, you're never going to believe it. And they were going, ah. So it was brilliant. It was brilliant. Those the ones that were there saw it, and the ones that had left couldn't believe that they'd missed it.
Yes.
So perfect. Yes, it was perfect.
Great, great. And then you mentioned already something about this Empire new album, that it's now done. So when we will see it coming out?
Well, we haven't affiliated with any labels.
Due to this touring schedule and everything.
Yeah, because the intention was to get it out this year. And initially I was looking at January. That didn't happen. And then I thought, March. And then I thought, maybe the end of the summer, maybe towards September. But of course, the Venoming thing just came on so heavy that it's like we by the time we finish at Christmas, we'll have done something like 130 shows this year between ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's like a third of the year. Yeah. So I was like, oh my God. And so, you know, it's just finishing it. So we'll use the gaps that we've got when this finishes at Christmas. If I could get them both out at the same time, would be amazing.
Okay.
So maybe in March would be fantastic. But I would prefer to have the Empire album out February, January,
yes.
February,
okay,
and then follow it with Venom Inc.
Yes.
But if they both get ready at the same time, why not? Who
cares?
What's
that here? Yes. You do the double releasing.
Yeah. Well, you know, Taurus, someone once said to me, you guys have been quite prolific. You know, you put a lot of records, you're always doing a lot of music, because in the last year and a half, it's like we haven't released anything. But in the first, you know, two or three, we were releasing something all the time. And and I said, okay, is that wrong? And they said, no, I wondered, you know, why you feel you want to release a lot of stuff. And I said, well, I don't feel we want to release. It's like we're in a band, and a band does this. The cycle goes, we write some songs, we record the songs, we release the songs, we go and play the songs, and we write some songs, then we record some songs, and there it goes. I said, so if we're writing, recording, playing, then writing, recording, playing, and that's the gaps are shorter, then who cares, you know?
In fact,
a band is about music. You're either playing it, recording it, or you're writing it. So, you know, that you could spend 10 years writing an album. You know, there's no reason as a creative to have 5 years in between albums. The reasons may be personal, you know, but certainly from a productive point of view. And Mantis is like a machine, you know, that's all he does. He just is in there all the time, you know, demoing things and writing things. And, you know, I'm a bit more last minute. I'm a bit more, not lazy, but I like to be under pressure. So I'll have, say, 3 months to write an album's worth of lyrics or something, and I'll wait till the night before to write all 10. And sometimes, you know, even when we did the album The Wastelands with Venom, and Clarice, one of the songs that a lot of people loved, the Silence of the Lambs song, I wrote that song in the studio as I was singing it. I sung a line, and then I listened to it, and then I wrote the next line, and then I listened to both, and then I wrote the next line, and I built the song as I went.
It's your way of doing, I mean, to get best out of you.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's the point.
You could write all of your questions down and tell me them. You could have sent me all your questions, and I could have sent you all my answers, and we could have went, okay, that's cool. Right, let's record that.
Mm.
And you could just read it, and I could just read it.
Yeah.
But there's no you involved. There's not that lovely smiley face and that lovely voice and those eyes and that whole nice warm way about you. There's not my ugly unshaven face sticking in your face. But
it
doesn't have, there's no spontaneity there.
Yeah, I know.
And you can't be creative when it's like that.
Yeah, that's true. I fully agree on this.
Yeah.
Great, great. Listen, now I would like to change completely the topic.
Okay.
Staying anyhow on stages, but in theaters.
Okay.
Films.
Okay.
Films. First of all, this part of actor in you, is it your something from your childhood, dream coming true, or something that you just got involved?
Well, you know, like everything with me, I don't plan everything, because I think you can't plan everything. Yeah. You should embrace the now. And so sometimes an opportunity comes and you can say yes or no. I'm not that I follow that, say yes to everything, but I do say yes to everything, because I think if I say yes and then I feel, oh, I shouldn't have said yes, I can say no. But if I say no, am I going to regret saying no? And I could have said yes. And when I go back to say yes, it's too late. You said no.
Yes.
So it's about opportunity and testing yourself, finding yourself, and seeing who you are and what you can do.
And challenging, you know, maybe also.
Challenge, completely. Yes. Yeah. You know, I used to do cartooning and stuff and caricatures. And, you know, was something I liked to do. And people would go, I can't draw. I said, you can draw. No, I can't draw. I said, everybody can draw. You just don't draw. Yeah, but I'm not very good at drawing. Ah, now you've just qualified yourself. You said you couldn't draw, and now you said you're not very good at drawing. And what I said to them is, the first time I drew, I wasn't very good.
Yeah.
But I kept drawing, and I got better. And that's all that life is. You know, this person is intelligent, and this person isn't. Really? Why is that person intelligent? Well, they know all about the universe. Right. How did they know that? Well, they studied it. Ah. Mm-hmm. So does that make them intelligent? They know about the universe because they studied it. This other person doesn't know because they don't have the information.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's all life is. Life, with your skills, is just information. You either have it or you don't. So instead of measuring yourself against someone who has all the information.
Yes, yes.
You just take from it and learn from it. And then you have the information. You know, that's why we can all tie our shoelaces. But when we were children, and our children couldn't tie their shoelaces, but now they can, because they learned to tie shoelaces.
Yes.
Were they stupid before and now they're intelligent? Of course not.
Yes.
It's just skill that they were shown. And I think I spent a lot of time working backstage in a theatre, just because I was in the north and I was looking for work, and a friend who I was a friend of a girlfriend, I bumped into him. And it just happened to be this job. So I went and I worked as a carpenter in a theatre. And I just found myself keeping in the theatre. Mm. And then I experienced my first Shakespeare on stage, which was Derek Jacobi as Richard III. And bang, it was like a light bulb went off. I was mesmerised by the performance.
Yeah.
And I went out and bought the book and followed it to play every night. Even though I was doing a job and people thought I was crazy because it's Shakespeare, I was mesmerized by this play, by this guy's performance. And within a month, I understood all the words speak, which is very difficult.
Yeah,
Shakespeare's English is very difficult.
Yeah.
But it was like someone was speaking normal English to me. And I understood everything, the meaning of everything. And it just intrigued me. And it always intrigued me. But I didn't think I wanted to do it, per se. But fast forward to, like, you know, several years later, maybe even 8 or so years later, I was working. I'd moved to London and was working at the Shakespeare Theatre.
Yeah.
And there was a tour of the world of a play called Comedy of Errors.
Mm.
And we found ourselves in India. And the touring party was quite small, just the cast. And then there was an assistant director, and then the director would come and visit from time to time.
Okay.
And on this particular occasion, we were in Mumbai and or New Delhi or something. And we were in New Delhi, and the assistant director and the director had gone to Mumbai to meet Mother Teresa.
Oh, dear.
So there was just the cast.
Yeah.
So I turned up at the theatre, and the stage management team said to me, we have a big problem. And I said, oh, shit, well, what's happened? And they said, one of the cast is very sick.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh, my God. And they said, we don't know what to do. And I said, right, well, it's India. Lots of actors in India, and they love Shakespeare. I'm sure we could probably find a local person who could fill in
some
small parts and do. And they said, we could do that, yes. But what we were thinking was, you know this play. And I said, yes. And they went, yeah, because every night you're quoting it. And I said, okay.
And you
said, so would you go on?
Yes, and you said be or not to be.
Exactly. I was thinking, oh. So I thought, yeah, okay, why not? So I did. It was fun, great fun, and I enjoyed it. And then we finished the tour, and yeah. I went home, finished in San Francisco, and I flew home. And that was it. And then it was about 4 weeks later, the director was in London and called my house. And they said, it's a call for you. It's Tim, the director. And I said, oh. So I went on and went, hey, how are you? How is everything? How was the tour? Yes, well, you know, we're doing the play in London. I said, yes, yes. How is it going? He said, well, do you remember in India where you covered for us? I said, oh, yes, that was great fun. Yeah, I liked that. And he said, okay, well, we've got a similar situation happening. Someone's mother has just died. Mm. They can't be in the play. And we were stuck for a few shows. And I can't think of anybody we can get in. So I went to the cast and asked them, did they know anybody? And everybody just shouted your name and said, get Tony, get Tony. So he said, I'm asking you, would you come down and rehearse now? And you'll be on tonight and through till Saturday, if you would. And I said, you know, okay, but on one condition, you don't have to pay me. Just teach me how to act properly. And that was it. He okay. did.
Great.
And it was wonderful.
Great. These are very interesting because, you know, when you get into new things and in a surprising way, you know, coincidence. Yeah. But anyhow, I think it was meant to be. And I was wondering if you'd like to tell me, taking one film, Master and Commander, where you were Mr. Lamb Carpenter.
I was Mr. Lamb the Carpenter, yes.
So how was it to work with Russell Crowe and his crew?
Amazing, and it's like another world completely. You know, after I did the training with Tim, they said, you're too old, you haven't been trained, you'll never get an agent. And then I got two agents wanted to take me. So they said, wow, that never happens. And I was like, oh, okay. And then they said, well, it'll be a long time before you do anything like on TV. And then I got a TV role straight away, and I was thinking, oh, okay. And then they said, yeah, but you want to do theatre, so, you know, probably you won't be able to do theatre if you do TV. And then I got a theatre role, and, you know, it was like, it was just happening. Yeah. And I don't know if I was giving out positive energy, and there were just things I thought, oh, I'd like to do. And then I turned around one day and said in just a conversation with some friends over coffee, I said, they said, what do you want to do then? I said, oh, I don't know. I said, oh, I'd like to do a movie, would be cool. And the next thing I know, I got cast for a small part in Judge Dredd with Sylvester Stallone and Amanda Santi.
Yes.
Unfortunately, like a lot of characters in Harry Potter, I ended up on the cutting room floor, so I didn't make the final cut. But it wasn't because I was shit, I guess. It was more to do with Synergy, who made Judge Dredd. Mm. They wanted to get a qualification that was like a 10 or something. Mm. So it was too violent. So they wanted to get all the violence out. So unfortunately, because I was a prisoner, most of the stuff I was involved was the violent stuff. So I got cut out a lot. But I still made the cut. But it was the experience I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
And then I did a job for Queen, the musical, We Will Rock You.
Yes.
So we were installing it in London for the musical.
Yeah.
And my agent called and said, could you go and meet this director? He wants to see you for a movie, but it's a Hollywood movie. And I was thinking, oh, right, just like the other one. But when I went, it was like in this big apartment and it was all really serious. And I met Peter Weir, who had done Gallipoli, Picnic at Hanging Rock, The Truman Show. And I was like, fucking hell. And he was going, yeah, we've got a big Hollywood star for it, but I can't say anything. And I was like, okay. And he said, yeah. So anyway, we did a bit of ad-libbing, and I went back to work. And my agent called and said, how did it go? And I said, shit, it was shit. I was so shit. I said, there's no way. I said, you know, this is like a proper movie, and they want me for a real character, and it's with a Hollywood A-list star, and it's in Mexico for 5 months we have to shoot. I said, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And she said, well, do you think you did okay? I said, no, I think if he picks me, he's got to be crazy. And a week later, she called me, and she said, are you sitting down? And I went, no. And she went, okay,
you
better sit down. And then she told me, she said, oh, you leave in March. You're shooting in Mexico for 5 months, and they called you Mr. Lamb. And I was like, no way. So, you know, I was filled with intrepidation because the cast was all seasoned veterans, young guys, but older actors, but that's what they do for a living. And, of course, Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany Peter Weir, and the first scene of the movie I had to do was the second shot of the whole movie. It was me and Russell Crowe, just the two of us.
Yes, I've seen the clips.
I remember getting onto the set and thinking there would just be like a cameraman and then the actors and the director. And when I walked into the stage set, there was like 200 people everywhere. And I was like, fucking hell. So I thought, well, nobody knows who I am. So I just wandered around to the coffee thing and just got some coffee. And I thought, well, I'll wait till I see somebody.
Yeah.
And I heard a voice say, Tony. And I turned round. All of the people in the place all turned round and looked at me. And I was like, with my cup of coffee, like, shit. And it was Peter Weir. And he said, could you join me and Russell? So I had to walk through all of these people in a big circle and then into this space where Russell Crowe is standing. And then I went up and I went, hi, and, you know, we spoke. And and then Peter described the scene and then they both looked at me and went, what do you think? And I was like, yeah, sounds great. Yeah.
I
was just thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? But me and Russell became great friends.
Okay. Now you gotta go, but I thank you very much for all the time and everything. We will talk soon again. But the last question, the word is yours. How would you like to conclude this our chat?
Well, I'd like to say thank you in particular very much for being beautiful and fantastic and supportive and just great to have you there. And I'd like to thank everybody for the support. And I hope to see everybody out there. Please come and see us. Please come and say hi. You know, people write to me all the time and go, if I had some albums, could I get them signed? If I met you, could I get a photograph? It's like, of course you can. That's the whole idea.
Yes.
This is a shared thing. It's yours as much as it's mine, as much as it's ours. So it's your thing. So anything you need, anything you want, just come and be part of it. And for all the support over the years and for the continued support, I support you as much as you support us. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. It means everything. And I hope I give everything I have back, which is part of who I am, but also because I appreciate the support.
Yes. Thank you, Tony. We will talk soon, very soon again. And have a great, great, great day. And go and burn the stages,
yeah,
each of them. And we will see. We will see at the end of this month.
All right. Lots of love. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.